Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery. If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Elizabeth Warren is dropping out of the presidential race, and it kind of feels like when your favorite teacher retires, you're sad to see her go, but also happy for her because she doesn't have to deal with your annoying classmates anymore.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth talks to Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Plus, just for this podcast, she takes a few more questions backstage at Studio AG. But first, a closer look.
The president went on Fox News and lied to millions of people about the coronavirus outbreak as his administration bungles its response to the crisis. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. I think it's safe to say at this point that the president of the United States is undermining public health. And I'm not just saying that because he looks like an outbreak monkey that escaped from a lab. Trump keeps lying to people about the potential threat posed by the spread of the coronavirus. While the United States lags behind other countries in testing, even though we've had time to learn from their experiences. One infectious disease expert called the lack of widespread accurate testing a national scandal. For example, the CDC website said today that 1,500 patients had been tested just at CDC. Meanwhile, Bloomberg News reported that in a short space of time, South Korea has managed to test more than 140,000 people. And they're using an ingenious new way to do it.
Outside of China, South Korea has the most coronavirus cases. They've come up with a new innovative way to test for the virus in the form of a drive-thru.
I'm going to show you drive-thru coronavirus testing. This is a free service that the city of Gaeyang is offering anybody. Vehicles come through here, and you get a questionnaire, you get your hands sanitized, and then you go through a number of stations here. The patients never get out of the car. They come in, they fill out questionnaires, find out whether or not they're in a risk category. And while sitting in their cars, the nurses will swab their nostrils and their throats, take samples, and then the results will come in within 2 to 3 days. This could be a model for countries like the U.S. that are just starting to deal with their first coronavirus cases.
Of course it should be a model for us. Look, we might be bad at stuff like healthcare, education, gun control, climate change, housing, criminal justice, and gender equality, but nobody is better than us at drive-thrus. I mean, come on. And nothing should appeal to our president more than treating healthcare like fast food. All we have to do is put coronavirus testing on the menu at every Wendy's and he'd go get one himself.
Yeah, I'll have 4 bacon cheeseburgers. 2 Frosties, chicken nuggets, and a cheek squab, yeah. And maybe supersize that swab. I got cheeks like a mainsail.
And yet we haven't gotten truth, transparency, or testing from the president, and that's because from the very moment news of the outbreak began to spread, Trump seemed to want to wish it away by denying the reality of the situation and telling people that one day the virus would just magically disappear.
You have 15 people And the 15 within a couple of days is going to be down to close to zero. We're going down, not up. We're going very substantially down, not up. I really think, Doctor, you want to treat this like you treat the flu, right? And, you know, it's going to be.
Looks like by April, you know, in theory, when it gets a little warmer, it miraculously goes away. I hope that's true.
It's going to disappear. One day, it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
As a general rule, never trust someone's medical advice when they use the word miracle. If you ask someone to look at a rash and they say it'll go away, and you ask how and they say, like a miracle, you need to go buy some ointment. Also, I don't trust Donald Trump on the subject of medical advice or miracles.
I have great relationship with God.
God is the ultimate. I mean, God created this. So, nobody, no thing, no, there's nothing like God.
The Bible certainly is one of, if not, I mean, it is the book.
Do you actively go to church?
Well, I go as much as I can, always on Christmas, always on Easter, and during the Sundays. I'm a Sunday church person.
Oh, are you a Sunday church person as opposed to like a Tuesday afternoon church person? Trump sounds like an atheist cop going undercover as a priest to spy on a bunch of Catholic mobsters. So, Father, what do you think of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ?
Oh, JC, well, you know, oh, he's just the ultimate. In the Bible, of course, you know, that's just the book, you know. And I go to church on Sundays. You guys, too? Get me out of here. They're on to me.
Trump's been trying to pretend the problem doesn't exist because he knows he'll get blamed for it, and he knows that because if he weren't president right now, he'd definitely be blaming whoever was president. In fact, yesterday, he even lied and blamed a past president for the current lack of testing.
The Obama administration made a decision on testing that turned out to be very detrimental to what we're doing, and we undid that decision a few days ago so that the testing can take place in a much more accurate and rapid fashion.
You can't blame Obama for something that didn't exist when he left office.
Obama should have never greenlit cats. I mean, you either go full cats or full people.
And it won't surprise you to learn that this lie was immediately debunked. Even the White House couldn't explain it. CNN reported that a source close to the coronavirus task force says it's not clear where Trump got his information. I have an idea where he got it. The same place he gets all his ideas. I won't say where it is, but I just hope he washed his hands. Trump knows this whole thing could be a challenge for him politically and for the economy, which is all that matters to him. In fact, MSNBC reported that during Trump's trip to India last month, he was paying close attention to TV news reports, not about the virus, but about the stock market.
Our reporting indicates that while he was in India, he was watching the stock market reaction very closely. He was very nervous and upset to see what was happening with the stock market. He seemed to be more aware of what was happening with the stock market than what was actually happening with developments with the virus.
Of course, because the stock market is the only thing Trump cares about. If you told Trump that spreading the coronavirus would actually help the stock market, he'd be doing press conferences giving people the opposite advice of doctors.
Remember not to block your sneezes, lick stuff in public, and just touch your face as much as possible. Just really get your fingers in there and knead it like dough.
Trump desperately wants to wish the situation away to avoid political accountability. That's why he decided to call into his favorite propaganda network, Fox News, and spread disinformation about the virus last night. For example, the World Health Organization announced this week that the official mortality rate for the coronavirus so far has been 3.4%, compared to the flu, which is about 0.1%. Now, with aggressive measures and testing, experts say it's certainly possible that number will come down. Instead, Trump told Fox News host Sean Hannity in a phone interview that he straight up doesn't believe those numbers.
We have a report today, the global death rate at 3.4%, and a report that the Olympics could be delayed. Your reaction to that?
Well, I think the 3.4% is really a false number. Now, this is just my hunch. I think that that number is very high. I think the number, personally, I would say the number is way under 1%.
Why are you going on national television and contradicting experts based on a hunch? First of all, the only hunch of yours that I trust is the one in your back after an hour at one of your rallies. I mean, look, normally you only hide your face like that when you're at a restaurant with your girlfriend and see your wife at the other table.
I love you, baby, and I don't care who knows. Oh, Carol.
So Trump lied to viewers about the mortality rate. Then there's the fact that employers and public health experts are urging anyone with any symptoms to stay home and self-quarantine rather than go to work and potentially spread the virus. Just yesterday, a county in Washington officially recommended teleworking, and both Amazon and Facebook asked their Seattle employees to stay home. But again, Dr. Trump disagreed.
A lot of people will have this, and it's very mild. They'll get better very rapidly. They don't even see a doctor. They don't even call a doctor. You never hear about those people. So if, you know, we have thousands or hundreds of thousands of people that get better just by, you know, sitting around and even going to work. Some of them go to work, but they get better.
So now he's telling people it's okay to go to work if they're sick. This from a guy who doesn't even go to work when he's healthy. So the president is spreading misinformation about a public health crisis in order to avoid political consequences. But at least he knows the name of the virus, right?
So you can't put them down in the category of the overall population in terms of this corona flu.
Jesus. The corona flu. Not only is he lying, he's making up new diseases now.
It's called the Corona Swine Ebola Flu. We just came up with very exciting. You can find it on the drive-thru menu at Wendy's.
This is the kind of public health crisis that tests the competence and honesty of our president. And obviously, Trump is completely unequipped on both counts. We need truth, transparency, and testing, and we're not going to get it from Donald Trump. Then again, that's
just my hunch.
This has been A Closer Look.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Our first guest tonight represents New York's 14th Congressional District in the House of Representatives. Please welcome back to the show Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Thank you for having me
back. Thank you for being here on such a busy week. I know they're all sort of busy at this point. But, you know, we were talking backstage. All of us have to be careful about our hygiene right now. You are obviously a politician who enjoys interacting with your constituents. There's a lot of handshakes, a lot of hugging. How is it overwhelming for you?
It can be overwhelming. I'm trying to, you know, make sure that I'm practicing great hygiene. Everyone learn how to wash your hands. I retweeted a hand-washing tutorial, and I was shocked by how many people were like, oh, wait, what? We were supposed to be doing this 20 seconds.
I will say when I heard 20 seconds, I thought, I'm just going to do normal and see where I get to. And it was, I definitely didn't break double digits. I know that. you know, you guys, the House voted to approve $8 billion in coronavirus aid, which is great. Matt Gaetz, we mentioned him in the monologue. He's one of your colleagues. He's a Republican, and he wore a gas mask.
Yes, he did. With matching shoes.
With the matching shoes. Yeah, I feel like nobody who's ever worn that mask has worn those shoes.
No, no.
Yeah, that's a real first.
I will say I have days in Congress where I feel like wearing a mask like that.
Yeah. Just not for, like, corona or anything.
Just the debate and the toxicity.
Yeah. Is it helpful when somebody goes to an important vote like that wearing a gas mask?
No, of course not. We're not here to incite panic.
Yeah. I will say he doesn't look panicked. He's just fully texting.
Yeah, he doesn't. Yeah. I do want to ask Representative Gaetz how often he washes his hands.
Yeah, that would be a good question, because then you don't need the gas mask if you just do that basic stuff. One of the things that, you know, a lot of people are discussing is who the president has chosen to put in charge of this task force. He chose Vice President Pence. Is it safe to assume that you do not think that's the best of his options?
No.
Yeah.
I think that we should have a person who believes in science.
Sure, that sounds good.
In charge of our response to the pandemic. Ideally, what we have is a person who believes in universal health care and paid sick leave and an agenda that actually can help prevent the transmission of disease.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned, you know, paid sick leave, because one of the things that's been pointed out by a lot of people is, especially in the food service industry, these are people with jobs that are very important to them. You know, they're just making ends meet as it is. And, you know, they are the ones that are most likely to pass on whatever illness they have to other people, and yet they don't have that opportunity.
Exactly. And the other issue, too, to compound on that, especially in food service, you know, a lot of people know that I used to work in a restaurant, and that just a couple weeks ago, Stephen Miller and the Trump administration rolled out a public charge rule against undocumented people, and many of whom we know work in the food service industry. And basically what it says is that if you are seeking medical care, that could be used against you in deportation proceedings. And so the people who feed us are now scared to seek medical care. This is not a situation that befits us as a country. And it's one that, frankly, I think shows that we are as strong as the most vulnerable, who we allow to be vulnerable and most vulnerable in our society.
You mentioned universal health care. You mentioned paid sick leave. I think these are probably some of the reasons that you have chosen to endorse Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
I do, while I have you, though, want to get your take on the fact that Elizabeth Warren, you know, suspended her campaign today.
Absolutely. Well, first and foremost, I think that we should all take a moment to acknowledge the historic candidacy that Elizabeth Warren represented in this cycle. Champion. And I think that she ran an absolutely stunning, incredible race. I'm looking forward to continuing this fight for Bernie as well. Tomorrow, or rather next week, we have contests in Michigan and many other states. And we need right now, I think what we are seeing in the primary contest is that this is a generational battle. And that we need young people to turn out to vote. It is young people that will champion student loan debt, Medicare for all, paid sick leave, a living wage, as well as our elders that have been in this fight for generations as well, fighting for a progressive future for the United States of America, which, by the way, is a winning future for the United States of America.
You mentioned the youth vote, and obviously, you know, when you look at the demographics of how people are voting, young people are flocking to Bernie Sanders. And yet, it does seem like what happened on Super Tuesday, maybe how we didn't meet his expectations, were that young people were voting less than they need to for Bernie's path. Why do you think young people are not coming out in the way that you would hope?
I think we're seeing kind of a wax and wane. In Iowa, we saw about, I believe, a 30% increase in youth turnout. And as we saw in Iowa, Bernie Sanders came in either, depending on who you're asking, he came in first or quite nearly first. Similar phenomena in New Hampshire with very high turnout. I think with Super Tuesday, with so many states voting at once, we have to reiterate that message because it is going to be... now and in November, I believe, turnout of young people that will have a huge determination in our future as a country. And this is an enormous responsibility. And we got to really, really turn up or else, you know, you get what you fight for and you get what you vote for. And I think it's so incredibly important that we fight for a future that will work for us, that we fight for a Green New Deal, that we fight for action on climate, that we fight for... ending our system of mass incarceration.
I want to talk more about November. We'll be right back with more from Congressman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Welcome back. We're here with Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So a lot of people are saying now that, look, we basically are down to two candidates, it seems like, and everyone's worried if one wins, will the supporters of the other agree to support the Democratic nominee? That's a question you get asked a lot. Is it safe to assume that you will support Joe Biden if he is the nominee?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, I've said that throughout this entire process that what is so important is that we ultimately unite behind who that Democratic nominee is. I think it's a two-way street. I've been concerned by some folks that say if Bernie's the nominee, they won't support him, and the other way around. Right now, November, you know, this is more important than all of us. And we really need to make sure that we defeat Donald Trump at the polls, assuming and knowing how insane it's going to get between now and then.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there's going to be a laid-back election season.
It's not going to be chill. No,
it's not going to be chill. It's not going to be like, honey, the debate's on. Let's get a glass of wine. One thing that must be surreal for you is 2016, you knocked on doors for Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
And then 2 years later, you get elected to Congress, and now you are actually on the stump with Bernie. Mm-hmm. When you go out on stage for these giant Bernie rallies, does it seem as surreal to you that I imagine it does?
It's completely surreal. Just, 4 years ago, I was in the South Bronx as a volunteer helping organize this massive rally in St. Mary's Park. And at the time, Bernie Sanders was one of the first Democratic candidates since, I believe, Robert F. Kennedy to campaign in the South Bronx. And to have a candidate that really saw our community was really impactful. And now to be able to go out and bear witness to what so many communities are experiencing all across the country is just very full circle and gratifying.
And obviously a lot's changed for you in the 4 years. Is it safe to assume that Bernie hasn't changed at all?
I think he's changed a little bit.
Okay,
I think he's changed. Although, he is famous for his consistency.
I think that for those who are drawn to Bernie, that is the thing that is impossible to argue with. As far as a politician with consistency over the years, he really stands out.
He does, and he's been fighting for healthcare as a right this entire time. And it's, now that I'm on the other side in Congress and you see how much pressure there is, to bow to a lot of special interests, the fact that he has been relying on small dollar donors since before the internet kind of blows my mind. It's like collecting little checks this whole time and really committed to a grassroots movement when it was way, way harder than it is even now is really phenomenal.
Another thing that will have huge implications, not just on this election, but the next decade, is the census. Can you speak about how you're approaching that and how, just try to explain to people exactly how important it is.
So we are all going to get census forms or a prompt. We're all going to get mailed a prompt to fill out the census in the next 2 weeks or so. And so I think what's really important is that we all fill this out. It happens once every 10 years. Every single person, no matter your documentation status, no matter your housing status, income, et cetera, is to be counted. And it determines how much our schools are going to get funded, how much infrastructure gets invested, and of course, how many members of Congress each community gets. And if you get undercounted, in some parts of New York City, some communities, the self-reporting is about half of what we think it should be. And that has real impacts on apportionment of how many teachers that your local schools get. So it's really important. It's completely confidential, and it's even confidential within the federal government. Your census data is not shared with any other federal agency at all. So don't worry if you're having a creative living situation and it's not going to be told to your landlord or anything crazy like that. Don't worry. Totally safe.
A good tip for my viewers. Hello to the 10 of you watching together right now. I'm very happy to see you got some companionship for yourself.
I
would imagine Washington, even though it's crowded with people, can be very lonely.
Yeah.
You got a new dog.
This is Deco.
These are very, very attractive photos of Deco. Were these professionally done?
This was taken in the House Rules Committee. He was a doggy chairman of the day.
Uh-huh.
He rotates, so there's a cast of characters, and so they very graciously invite the dogs of many members.
This was not a special treatment for you. It's a rotating set of
dogs. Yeah, it's a thing. So there's a lot of different doggy chairs of the day.
That's great. By the way, I don't know why that's not on C-SPAN.
It should be.
C-SPAN is boring and needs more dogs.
It would be like Puppy Bowl.
Exactly. Hey, thank you so much for being here. It's always really nice to have you on the show. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, everybody.
Hey, this is Henry from Late Night.
And this is Sal from Late Night.
We are here with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, which is incredibly exciting.
Oh, no, of course. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. One thing that when you read about your works thus far, you've been in Congress for about a year, mm-hmm. people say is that you show up to all the hearings, you show up to the votes as if that's a crazy thing in D.C. And it seems like it is a crazy thing. Do people just not show up to work regularly or show up completely ill-prepared when they are there?
I think a decent amount of people will show up for their 5 minutes of questions, but hearings last several hours and they're designed for us to really learn. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't stay for the entirety of their hearings. They're very busy dialing for dollars in order to stay in elected office, which is, of course, one of the huge foundational corrupting aspects of our current democracy.
It's also very notable in some of the most well-known hearings that have been televised. And I'm curious for your reflection on this, the distinction between being like extremely well-prepared and prosecutorial about your questions and then others, mostly in the Republican Party, just like going off on random stem winders about non sequiturs and bringing in posters that like with Michael Cohen's face that just say liar, liar, pants on fire.
Yeah.
Like, I'm curious just to what it feels like for you to like, you're very obviously doing your homework and other people are like scrolling through their notes or rambling incoherently.
Yeah, I think there's a real aspect too that when I first got to Congress, I worked so hard and it was so unlikely for a person like me from a working class background to get there that once I got there, I was like, okay, I'm going to take this very seriously. And then you kind of juxtapose that with this old boys club that's like, oh, my uncle gave me this seat. Like, what's good? Like, is there a Google on your Apple and in front of Mark Zuckerberg? And you're like, why? Like, this is a very serious job that we're doing.
Well, there was a hearing where someone asked Mark Zuckerberg how Facebook makes money. And he was like, ads. Like, how are you the one asking questions about this?
These are also just Googleable. These don't even require, like, doctorate. Right. You don't have, like, to have a PhD.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, because you ran against the establishment in your race. Joe Crowley was one of the most establishment figures. And now you're certainly not establishment, but you're in D.C. You're part of Congress, and there is still an establishment. And then also in 2018, all these new candidates came in that were not part of it. How do you and that group of people negotiate that space between being an activist in Congress with the reality that you do hold the seat in power and there is this kind of establishment itself within the party?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there is always that juxtaposition, and sometimes it's a contradiction of you are trying to shape and mold a system that you disagree with, but of which you are also a part of. And so there's a lot of negotiating with yourself that you have to do in figuring out how do you keep your commitments while also living in this flawed system. And so for me, one of the big things, at least that I feel as a freshman member of Congress, institutionally, you have very little power. Like, you're just a scrub. You just showed up. Everything runs by seniority. You have no power. And so that's why I think leaning on the bullhorn and the bully pulpit is actually very important for someone with less institutional power. And you can use that to build institutional power. So I tend to think of our politics and Congress as kind of fish swimming in a bowl. And you can use the bullhorn and public conversation instead of like changing how the fish swim to change the vessel in which they are swimming. And that can help draw consensus to an issue, particularly when you're just showing up as a 29-year-old with like very little institutional connection at the start.
Speaking of running against the establishment, I was wondering if you might be able to reflect on some of the findings that are in the exit polls from Super Tuesday, which seem like incredible to remark upon just the progress that's made in a few years on the views of Democratic voters. So Medicare for All, for example, seems to sweep in all exit polls to have at least a plurality of support in every state that voted. And an amazing finding to me was that in Texas in particular, I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, 57% of Democratic primary voters said they had a favorable view of socialism in an exit poll. So, of course, as a self-described Democratic socialist and also just as somebody who has campaigned on these issues of justice, I'm just wondering if you can reflect on what that feels like to see that in Super Tuesday exit polls.
I mean, of course, it's extraordinarily gratifying because generations of activists have worked so hard to get us to this point so that we are winning on the ideas. And, you know, Medicare for All swept in the polls. And when we talk about issues like democratic socialism, I think that this and many other issues are very much generational. And I think we're kind of coming together as a party and saying, wait, maybe $200,000 of student loan debt isn't a good thing. Maybe thousands of dollars of insulin a month isn't a good thing. Maybe we can reassess our priorities as a country and we shouldn't be scared about how our opponents define us.
Can I ask you one other really quick pet peeve thing that just occurred to me off my, my head real quick, because I have a connection to the Bronx. You often hear in the media people talk about like getting out of the East Coast and West Coast bubbles, quote unquote, and going to talk to like real Americans who are undercovered. And it's certainly the case that you should go talk to voters everywhere in every place in the country. But there's something that bothers me about how like New York and LA and the coasts, quote unquote, everything seems to get like lumped into being like Manhattan, for example, or like the New York media bubble.
Absolutely.
You represent the Bronx and Queens. There are just as many people there who have just as many real needs and who are not, because it's a solidly blue state in the Electoral College or for any other reasons, not necessarily given that sort of same voice in the media.
Yeah.
And so I'm just curious how you fight that.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that really irked me this cycle, because in my opinion, you cannot be a Democrat that's out here complaining about the Electoral College and then saying that only Indiana has real Americans and that like only people in Indiana have values. I represent a profoundly working class district that I actually think also represents a cross section of America. I have white working class voters. I have immigrant voters, South Asian immigrant voters, black voters, white voters, Latino voters, young, old, and they're all profoundly working class. And also on top of that, when people try to use this dog whistle of what the Midwest is like, the Midwest elected Ilhan Omar. The Midwest elected Rashida Tlaib. And the idea that the Midwest, I mean, let's be real about what people are saying when they say that. They're talking about white people. And if you want to say that, say it. You know, people talk about black electorates. People talk about women voters. If you want to talk about white people and white voters, say what you mean and say, I believe older white voters will or will not do this. Just the same way people say older black voters, younger Latino voters, etc. But to use these dog whistles of how the real America or what the real America thinks is really just kind of vocalizing this internalized, colonialized, racialized, you know, class-ized bias. And I think it's really important that that's at least acknowledged when someone is talking about that.
One of the most like marquee pieces of legislation, or I guess not pieces of legislation, but kind of frameworks you've pushed, is the Green New Deal. Mm-hmm. You read it into the record last week, early this month. Yes. But then a lot of people on the right were like, this is the most ridiculous thing. This is so crazy. Nothing's going to ever happen. And of course, like there is no Green New Deal that's passed through the Trump administration. But do you see the real progress that that's kind of had in the past year? Every candidate running for president has signed on to it. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me like, I don't know if it's directly tied, but it's pushed the conversation about climate justice that we're definitely having in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, when we were drafting the Green New Deal as a team internally, one of our stated goals was that if this is discussed or a Green New Deal is discussed at a presidential debate, that would have been one of our markers of success.
Wow.
If we were able to move the conversation on climate to that level, like that was actually one of our internal goals.
You got a whole CNN forum.
Think about climate. And the reason for that is because, as we saw in 2016, there wasn't a single question about climate change. And this is the existential crisis of our time. And not only that, so that was one stated goal, which we were successful at. And the other was literally changing the scale upon which our elected leaders thought about solutions to climate change. And up to that point, the biggest, boldest, kind of most ambitious proposal that people were considering was a carbon tax. And that was to the tune of maybe a couple million dollars or even hundreds of millions of dollars. But this is a multi-billion or, frankly, multi-trillion dollar problem. And so our second goal was to change the standard scale upon which anyone would consider what was a serious climate solution and what wasn't. And so and the third, of course, was to introduce principles of economic justice as essential to any climate plan. And I believe that we met all three of those goals, and I'm very proud of the team and the activists and the advocacy communities that have been part of this.
And so quickly, too, so quickly, you achieved so much on the Green New Deal and the way we talk about climate. It's so impressive.
Thank you.
And I'll just speak for myself very quickly, because I understand from Fox News they'll be banned under the Green New Deal. I'm willing to give up all of my many cows. I have a whole herd. I'm a dairy farmer. I'm willing to give up all of it, because obviously they'll be banned under the Green New Deal regime. No. Yes, of course.
we don't want to feed the narrative. But yeah, no, I think it's I think the intensity with which the right seized on it is also a reflection of how powerful this was. They're scared because they do not, they're not ready. They're not ready. And they're not ready to lead. And as we see, they really haven't been able to lead.
But the degree to which like debates and exit polls show that these big, ambitious ideas are now part of mainstream political dialogue is just an incredible milestone. So thank you for all of your work doing
that.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank everyone who thinks this is important because that's really how this was achieved.
It's amazing. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for chatting with us. And thank you for the work you're doing to create
so
a more just world and a more healthy environment. The goals you have are extremely large and lofty, and you are accomplishing so much so quickly. It's incredibly impressive.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're huge fans.
Thank you.
We're
huge fans. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.